You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Countless burgers hit the grill and celebratory fireworks lit up the sky across the nation this weekend. With America celebrating its 250th birthday, the historical backdrop of the 4th of July, the signing of the Declaration of Independence was front and center. In speeches on Saturday, both sides of the political spectrum mentioned our nation's founding document. Here is President Donald Trump speaking at the National Mall.
In Philadelphia, our founding fathers summoned the courage of giants and the wisdom of centuries to boldly proclaim these timeless truths. They declared that all men are created equal, that they are endowed with sacred, unalienable rights by the hand of our Creator, and that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
And here at home, Governor Gavin Newsom giving his own speech to mark the holiday.
250 years ago, 56 men in Philadelphia signed their names to one of the most radical sentences ever written: that governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed. I'll repeat that again: from the consent of the governed. That clause was treason. It was a line that terrified every monarchy in Europe. It was the line that made America possible.
So in a fractured political landscape, reverence for the Declaration of Independence still transcends party lines. But our next guest argues that there's still big misunderstandings and myths surrounding our founding document. Carlton Larson is a Martin Luther King Jr. Professor of Law at UC Davis and the author of the new book, One Nation Under Law, The Meaning of the Declaration of Independence. Welcome, Professor Larson.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So before we dive into the Declaration of Independence, I'd just like to learn more about your personal connection to our nation's history. Were you a big history buff growing up?
Yeah, always been interested in history. And actually, the Declaration of Independence I've been interested in since I was 6 years old after a trip to New England with my family. And I came up with the idea of writing a book that would be America's founding documents, Mayflower Compact, Declaration of Independence. And so at 6 years old, I started typing this out, the Declaration of Independence on my mother's typewriter, you know, one letter at a time. Probably didn't even know what all the words meant. But my parents were very kind. They didn't tell me that such books existed. I don't know if I even finished the whole document, but I still have those old pages. And so it's just sort of something that has sparked my attention really since a very young age.
Yeah, I mean, it's manifested, of course, into the books that you're authoring today. Why do you think that that fascination has stayed with you throughout your life and your career?
Yeah, it's a very good question. There's certain things that I think a person just relates to in a way that almost escapes logical analysis. I think when you ask lawyers, why are you interested in this field of law, or why is a historian interested in this period or that other, you can't really explain it. It's almost like a romantic connection. You see something about this that just lights a spark in you, and it almost can't be explained, but you just feel it. And when you have that feeling, then you just get sucked into that period and that issue, and it's kind of hard to let go of it.
So the Declaration of Independence is one of the most studied documents in history. It's pretty modest in length. You can read it in about 10 minutes or so. But I would also think that can be a limited way to look at this document. Would you consider it a living document like the Constitution?
Well, in some ways it is, in the sense that we continue to argue about it, we continue to debate it, it continues to inform our political discussions in many ways. But at the same time, it's not a governing law in the way that the Constitution is. It had a particular purpose, and that purpose was to sever our political relationship with Great Britain. So to that extent, it's not a living document in quite the same way we might think of as the Constitution, which has, of course, been amended many times throughout our history. The Declaration's text is what it is.
How does your experience as a law professor shape how you view the Declaration of Independence?
So I think that's one of the things that this book is somewhat distinctive about, is really thinking about the Declaration from the lens of law. And there's a lot of people who've looked at it from the lens of history or philosophy or other fields. But thinking about the Declaration as a legal document, you can see that what it does, of course, it has a legal effect. that is severing our ties with Great Britain. But that also has a lot of ripple consequences going forward. And so the document continues to have what I call continuing legal significance. That is, it's not directly binding law, but it shows up in court opinions a lot. I looked at over 3,400 court decisions where the Declaration of Independence is invoked. Sometimes it's just rhetorical decoration, but in many other cases, it's actually doing a lot of legal work. And one of the most typical ways is taking a look at the charges against the king, where the king has done all these bad things. And then a court says, well, if this was bad enough to justify independence, then this is almost certainly something we don't want to tolerate in American law today. And so that's using the Declaration of Independence as what I call kind of a negative constitution. It's a guide of what not to do.
Mm. That's so interesting because, you know, as you laid out, the Declaration of Independence is not a legally binding document. It came years before the Articles of Confederation, 11 years before the Constitution. So there was some time between these documents. So how exactly did our nation's founding document lead to the creation of America as a nation?
So there's a lot of debate as sort of when the United States was founded as a nation, and some people will tell you it's the Constitution, some people tell it's the Articles of Confederation. I think that the view out on the street, which I think is correct, is that it was July 4, 1776. We're celebrating the nation's birthday, the birthday of a nation. And one thing we get confused by is there was no written Constitution. Right, so we obviously have the written Constitution from 1787. We have the Articles of Confederation, which are ratified in 1781. But what happened between 1776 and 1781? Well, we were a country. We were the United States of America. And we had what was, in effect, an unwritten Constitution because it took so long for the Articles to get ratified. And an unwritten Constitution was perfectly understandable to people at the time. That's what Great Britain had. That's what England had before that. It's sort of the way the government is set up, and it's just based on popular consent. And that's what the Continental Congress did. It operated as essentially a national legislature supervising the war, sending diplomats to Europe, representing itself as the representatives of one nation to the rest of the world. And so we effectively were a nation, but under an unwritten constitution.
Mm. You know, one of the contentions you make in the book, and I found this so interesting, is that the document in the National Archives is not the real Declaration of Independence. So that might be surprising to many people. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. So if you go into the National Archives, you see this wonderful display and you see this very interesting parchment. And it has all these signatures on it. It's faded now. It's almost very hard to read. And that's labeled as the Declaration of Independence. And it says at the top, you know, in Congress, July 4, 1776. But if you ask where was that parchment on July 4, 1776. The answer is that it was probably lying in a shop somewhere in Philadelphia. And it is possible, although just by a matter of days, that it was actually part of a live sheep wandering around a Philadelphia pasture just waiting to be turned into parchment. And that's because that parchment wasn't prepared until mid-July 1776. It was done as what I call a ceremonial parchment. It was meant to create an elegant record of the Declaration, and so it was handwritten by a man named Timothy Matlack. He was a well-regarded Philadelphia brewer and also a well-renowned cockfighter, but he had very elegant penmanship, and so he prepared this. And then later, starting in August 1776, individual delegates began to sign. They signed through many months later. Some of them weren't even there on July 4, 1776. Some of those who were there on July 4, 1776 never did sign. So it's actually a very sort of confusing record what actually happened on July 4. Now, if you look at what happened on July 4, it was something very different. The Continental Congress prepared a text of the Declaration, and they sent it to a Philadelphia printer named John Dunlap. And that night, he prepared multiple copies, several hundred of them, that were then distributed to the states that were used as the basis of reprintings in American newspapers. That's the document we call the Dunlap Broadside. And that, I argue, is the original and the actually only legally binding text of the Declaration, because that's the one that was actually distributed to the American people. The parchment copy that was signed was squirreled away. Nobody saw it. It wasn't publicly revealed until early 1777.
Are there big differences between the two?
There are. I mean, not Most of the text is the same, but I think there are a couple of very critical differences that people have made a lot. So first is the caption. The caption to the parchment says it's the Declaration of the 13 United States of America. So it sounds like the Declaration is written in the voice of the states, that it's the states declaring independence. But that's actually inconsistent with the text of the document, which is really written, as I argue in the book, in the voice of the American people. And the caption to the original, the true Declaration of Independence, is it's a declaration by the representatives of the United States of America. And so it's the representatives speaking in the voice of America. And there's also a difference in the capitalization. So in the parchment copy, in several places, Timothy Matlack wrote United States with a small u.
Right, yeah.
And so a lot of people looked at it and said, that's critical. It tells us this wasn't a United States of America as a country. It was just a group of states that happened to be united. That lowercase u is the giveaway. Well, if you look at Matlack's, the rest of his text, you see random capitalization all over the place. It's utterly meaningless, the way he put those letters together. And when you go look at the Dunlap broadside, you don't see that. And then I looked at every single reprinting done in 1776, and not one of them uses that lowercase u with a capital S, capital A. That's not how anyone outside of the people who looked at this parchment would have seen the document. And so the people who place all that emphasis are essentially reading a whole lot into a secret document with random capitalization, and that argument is undercut by every other copy of the Declaration.
You know, often the first name people think of is Thomas Jefferson when thinking of the Declaration of Independence, but you also argue his contributions might have been overrated. Why?
Yeah, so Thomas Jefferson was part of the committee of five people that were appointed to draft the Declaration, and he took the lead. He obviously is should be credited as the drafter of the Declaration. But of course, he was writing it in the voice of someone else. He was writing it in the voice of the American people and in a document to be approved by the Continental Congress. And it's ultimately the Continental Congress that is, I think, correctly considered the author of the document, because the committee edited Jefferson's draft, and then the Congress as a whole edited Jefferson's draft quite significantly, cutting out large chunks of it. And no one really knew Jefferson was the drafter until many years later. And the problem with focusing on Jefferson too much is that we tend to ask the question, to understand the Declaration of Independence, we have to understand Thomas Jefferson.
Oh, connected to the man.
Yeah. So then we start asking questions like, well, what does Thomas Jefferson think about religion? Or what did Thomas Jefferson think about politics? Or what did Thomas Jefferson think about philosophy? And all those things are interesting, but they don't really tell us about the meaning of the Declaration of Independence, which is a public document adopted by a public body. And Jefferson always said, I was not trying to be original here. I'm trying to distill the sense of the American people into this document. And the analogy I use in the book is, think about, the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Some staffer in Congress drafted that, the text of it. Do we care who that staffer is or what they thought or what they thought about particular issues? And when we try to understand what the Civil Rights Act of 1964 means, no, we don't. Because it's Congress that adopted it, and so we care what Congress thought. And same thing here. When we think about the Declaration of Independence, we really need to be thinking, what did the Continental Congress think? And Jefferson's views can be somewhat illuminating on that point, but only to the extent that they're shared with everybody else. And so if you have the view Jefferson has an odd view on X, that doesn't mean that that's the view of the Declaration of Independence.
Mm. You know, the drafter of or drafters of the Declaration, really kind of like front and center, all men are created equal. But the reality is many of them were slave owners, of course. Those rights also were not afforded to tribal or indigenous people, of course, not women as well. So as a scholar, how do you reconcile that language in our founding document with the reality of the creation of American slavery?
Yeah, I mean, this is really sort of the central question of American history, of American identity, right? How did people who expressed these views do things that seem so inconsistent with those views? And what a lot of people have said is that the way to resolve that is to conclude that they didn't really mean it. That when they say all men are created equal, they mean all nations are created equal, or they mean that all white people are created equal, or they mean that, all people are equal in a state of nature, for example. But it doesn't really mean anything the way we would think about it in terms of human equality. And so they say that's, you know, we're reading back 21st century or 20th century views into the 18th century. And I think the answer to that is that's just wrong. because there were people right there in 1776 who said, this is wrong. Slavery is wrong. It's inconsistent with the Declaration of Independence. You cannot reconcile slavery with all men are created equal. That was said in the two major British responses to the Declaration of Independence in 1776. It was part of several Americans writing in 1776 who identified this tension. The New Jersey legislature in 1778 quoted all men are created equal when they said you can't discriminate on the basis of race when ordering requisitions for the military. And so there were plenty of people at the time who identified that very inconsistency. And so I think that the best way to read this is that the practices simply were inconsistent with the ideals. And it's not anachronistic to point that out. People at the time did exactly that.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with UC Davis Law Professor Carlton Larson. He is the author of the new book, One Nation Under Law, The Meaning of the Declaration of Independence. You know, right off the top in your description for your book, I mean, you argue one of the biggest misconceptions that you cite stems from an argument that the Declaration created 13 independent nations upon its signing. I mean, you touched upon this in the parchment of the Declaration of Independence and those inconsistencies. Why is that such a misinterpretation? I mean, is that a misinterpretation even today?
Yeah, so we see even, you know, I think in 2019, the U.S. Supreme Court, in an opinion by Justice Clarence Thomas, invoked this idea that there were 13 originally completely sovereign and independent nations, and that only later did they form the United States of America. And so under this view, Virginia and North Carolina in, say, 1777 were no different than France and Spain in terms of their relation to each other, that these were completely independent sovereign nations. And if you take that view, you end up with a very state-centric view of the American founding. And you could certainly read the text that way, but when you actually look at what actually happened, you don't see anything that looks like that. So just to take one example, the first appeal from a state court to a federal tribunal was filed on July 4, 1776. And that was an appeal from a Pennsylvania state court in an admiralty case, and the Continental Congress ultimately reversed the decision of the state court. That power was being exercised by the Continental Congress without an Articles of Confederation. They were using federal power to reverse the decisions of a state court. That doesn't look anything like France and Spain. And that issue was debated over prior to the Articles of Confederation. The Continental Congress insisted on the legitimacy of this jurisdiction. The Supreme Court of the United States, after the Constitution, later affirmed it in a very important case called Penhallow versus Doane's administrators. And the thrust of all of this was that there was a confederation in place, and that confederation in various ways bound the states and that they could not violate federal law. And so when you sort of look what actually happened on the ground, it just doesn't look anything like 13 completely independent nations.
Yeah, context is key. And now I can understand why, you know, the meaning of the Declaration of Independence, you know, can still be debated and argued over 250 years later. I mean, I let off the top that, you know, both President Trump, Governor Newsom, as well as other elected officials, I mean, they cited the Declaration in their 4th of July speeches over the weekend, which isn't necessarily surprising. But what stands out to you about the interpretation of our country's founding document? Because it can differ depending on the elected official who's quoting it.
Yes, that's very true. Everybody loves the Declaration of Independence. And so in the book, I have Trump and Harris at the beginning, and they're both invoking the Declaration of Independence. No, safe to say no politician in the United States is going to go out and trash the Declaration of Independence. This is just one of those things that everybody reveres. But it's also something that can be interpreted in various ways. And so you also see it on the Supreme Court, for example, the language of, you know, all men are created equal. This was bitterly debated between Justices Thomas and Justice Jackson in the affirmative action case. Justice Thomas says affirmative action violates that principle in the Declaration. Justice Jackson says no, affirmative action helps support that principle. I think both of them sincerely believe that. I don't think either will ever be persuaded by the other one. There are certain sort of intractable disagreements that we're going to have forever. I mean, we've been arguing about these things for 250 years. We'll be arguing about them for probably another 250 years.
Yeah, and you've learned a great deal since you were, 6 years old going to New England. I mean, even back in 2001, you published a paper that laid the foundation for many of the arguments that you make in this book. That was 25 years ago. So this has played a big role in your life and in your career.
Yeah, it has. It's one of those things when I tell other law professors I'm working on the Declaration of Independence, they kind of roll their eyes, maybe take a few steps back, because it's the sort of thing that is seen as perhaps attractive to nuts. Pro se litigants, cite it all the time. Somebody has violated their pursuit of happiness, and so they are suing, and their case gets tossed out. But what I hope to persuade not just my fellow law professors, but also fellow Americans, is that there is actually a lot worth considering with respect to the Declaration of Independence.
Well, Professor Larson, thank you for stopping by.
Thank you. Very much enjoyed it.
Carlton Larson is a Martin Luther King Jr. Professor of Law at UC Davis and the author of the new book, One Nation Under Law, The Meaning of the Declaration of Independence. We have a link where you can find the book on our Insight page. Still ahead, hitting midlife can bring a wave of self-reflection, looking back at the pieces we might have lost along the way. We'll learn about one woman's powerful transformation inspired by exploring different bodies of water, many in California. The author of the memoir, Midstream, A Life Remade in 50 Swims, joins us. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.